Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is now at home recovering from a cracked pelvis. She hopes to be back on the air next week. We're all looking forward to that day, too. Hala Esfandiari was visiting her mother in Iran 2 years ago, as she had often done before. This time, she faced a Kafkaesque nightmare, months of interrogation and then arrest and solitary confinement in the infamous Evin prison, the charge attempting to foment a velvet revolution. The Iranian-American scholar tells her story in a new book, My Prison, My Home, and she joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan.
We're inviting our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can send us a tweet or send us a message on Facebook. Well, I know this is a day that you will not forget. December 30th, 2006, you were in Tehran. You had said goodbye to your mother. You were ready to head back to the United States. What happened then?
We were driving to the airport with a driver who has been serving the family for a number of years. And my mother trusted him very much. Halfway through the route to the airport, a car tried to push us to the side of the road. I will never forget the color of that car. It was a dark green Peugeot sedan. And I thought probably we had a flat tire, so they were motioning to us. But then when the driver tried to maneuver his way away from them, they blocked us. And suddenly, four men with wielding knives jumped out of the car. One opened the door and came and sat next to me. And the other three, one asked the driver to open the trunk and probably took my suitcase because my suitcase wasn't there. And another one grabbed my carry-on bag, which was on the front seat. And the guy who was sitting next to me not only took my purse, but he stretched out and put his hands in my coat pocket because it was December. I was wearing an overcoat. And I really was shocked. I still didn't know what had happened. And once he took my purse, I noticed that this must be a robbery. And a robbery on the road to the airport was not an uncommon thing. So I said, please, naive me, I said, please leave me my passport and my ticket and just take the rest, take everything else you want. And his boss probably came to the window, to the side of the car and said, did you find everything? And the guy nodded and said, yes. And he left the car. The boss was a pockmarked face, and I will never forget his face. He really looked sinister in that dim light of around 1:30 in the morning on a winter night, told me to go under the seat. And I said, I just can't. I won't fit in. And he started using swear words that I had not heard in my entire life, and I'm quite well versed in the Persian language.
So this was a robbery, but when did you realize that it was more than just a highway robbery?
2 days later, The next day, I went to the passport office and applied for a passport and went to the police and did all the paperwork. But then when I went back to the passport office, the guy, the head of the passport office said, why don't you step out and someone wants to talk to you? So I stepped out and I thought probably this is routine questioning because I had not had an Iranian passport issued in Iran for over 30 years. So I stepped into another room. There was this young man in his 30s with a smirk on his face and a laptop. He always carried a laptop and always wore the checkered shirt and a parka on it. And he started questioning me, you know, what is your name? What's your family name? And tell me the story and so on. Then when he said, you're married to a Jew, that should have rang a bell. It still didn't, to be very honest with you. But then when he continued asking about the name of my grandchildren who were 4 and 6 then, and I thought this is a bit funny, but I still was not 100% sure what he was aiming at. Then I went home and I got a call from this guy who gave me an address and he said, we would like to talk to you. Come to this branch of the passport office. And the moment he gave me the address of the branch, I knew this was the intelligence ministry.
What was the address he told you to go to?
It was on...
I mean, what was the building? Why did you know that it was
I knew
bad
the building
news?
Because this used to be the house of a prominent Iranian businessman before the revolution. I had not visited it, but I knew of it and I knew the businessman. So, and I had heard that after the revolution, when they confiscated the house, at first they were using it as a place for a rehab center for street women. And then the intelligence ministry took over and they would question people there. So I knew what it was.
And so what was it? This started months of interrogation, daily interrogations for you. What was it that you were asked about? Why were they so interested in holding you in Iran?
It was the nature of my work at the Wilson Center that made them very suspicious of me. The intelligence ministry people are not familiar with the way research centers, think tanks, work in the United States and in the West. So they thought that if you are interested in Iran, if you are an Iranian, you know, by birth, and you have a relatively prominent position in that center, I am running the Middle East program there, and you keep on organizing meeting on Iran, there must be a hidden agenda. You know, there must be a sinister motive behind it. And for the intelligence ministry, the hidden agenda was the overthrow of the regime.
Now, you had all this interrogation, but you were allowed to go home, stay with your mother.
Yeah.
One day you came, he told you you were under arrest.
Yes.
Where did they take you then?
They called me to another building, not that building, to the main intelligence ministry building, you know. And I thought it's another interrogation. So because I hadn't heard from them for a number of weeks. So when I went there, the same guy, Mr. Jafari, who was my companion, unwanted and unwelcome companion for 8 months inside and outside prison, came to the room and I was taken aback. He didn't have his laptop. So I thought that he was going to say, we are done, you can go. He took out from his pocket a bunch of crumbled paper and took one piece of paper. I never saw that paper. It could have said anything on it. It said, this is the warrant for your arrest and we are taking you to Evin prison. I froze. I just couldn't believe it.
Evin prison is quite well known and dreaded. Tell us a little about this place and why it would send such a chill up your spine.
The prison was built under the monarchy, under the previous regime, where political prisoners and ordinary prisoners were kept there. Even under the previous regime, we had heard about stories about torture and mistreatment of prisoners. And after the revolution, it continued to be the main prison for political prisoners, for members of the previous regime who were taken in. And one had heard horrible stories about torture, mass executions, rapes. All these allegations that you hear now were also heard after the revolution. And I knew about it.
For 105 days, you'd be held at this prison. What kind of treatment did you have during that time?
I was kept in solitary confinement in the women's ward of the political prison ward. I was subjected to long hours of interrogation, blindfolded, sitting and facing the wall. I had two interrogators. One was that famous Mr. Jafari, and one was his boss. I never saw the boss. When he was interrogating me, which was on a daily basis, I had to sit and face the wall. And I told him one day that this is the first time ever I'm speaking to a person without looking into his or her eyes or without looking at him. And he said, you know, to my shame, you can't see me. So that was it. The interrogation was very tough. I didn't know what was going on in the outside world. They didn't tell me anything. And they threatened me with putting me on trial and keeping me there for a long time.
We're talking to Hala Esfandiari about her new book, My Prison, My Home. We're going to take a short break. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. When we come back, we'll talk about how she kept her sanity during these 105 days and what she learned afterwards about what was going on in the outside world to win her release. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Hala Esfandiari. She's the author of My Prison, My Home. She's also director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Her areas of expertise include Middle Eastern women's issues and contemporary Iranian politics. She's also the author of Reconstructed Lives, Women and Iran's Islamic Revolution. We should back up a bit and talk about your previous life. You were born in Iran. When did you decide to immigrate to the United States?
We left Iran immediately before the revolution because the reason was that they had closed the schools and my husband was still in Iran. He joined us a year after the revolution. But, I mean, the turmoil did not allow us to stay. And that's when we decided to come to the U.S.
And what year was that?
That was in 1980.
Now, your mother remained in Tehran.
Yes.
when you came to the United States. Why did she want to stay?
Well, my father was still alive, and my father had very deep roots in Iran, and there was no way he would leave Iran. Even during the Iran-Iraq war, he refused to leave Tehran and go to one of the villages. You know, he had very deep roots in Iran, and there was no way he was going to leave, and my mother wanted to stay with him. And so we left, and she stayed, and they stayed. And then when he passed away, we thought that she would join us, either me or my sister who lives in Austria, but she said no.
And why didn't she want to leave?
She loved Iran. She had a wonderful life in Iran, and she was very faithful to my father as long as he lived, and to the idea that, to the ideals that my father cherished all his life.
Now, you had visited her regularly in Tehran over the years. Had you had troubles before when you
Never.
Had gone there? So what was different now?
I think it was the Ahmadinejad area that made it so difficult, you know. And one was very cautious and careful because you felt there was something in the air that was not so pleasant. You know, you had to, someone like myself, who always went and looked up writers, you know, artists and so on, I was very careful. Once Ahmadinejad became president, I decided all I will do is to go and visit my mother and come back. So I stopped doing all the things I did before.
Now, you, when you were in prison, were you? What did you think was going on in the outside? Did you think there was a big foment for your release, or did you think perhaps nothing was happening?
I was given the impression that nothing was happening. Because my interrogators kept on telling me that they care more for my release than the outside world. And I was completely cut off. I was in solitary confinement. I was allowed to call my mother 3 times a week, and the guard would stand next to me. And all we could exchange is, how are you? How is my husband? And how are the children? And she would always say, everybody is doing their best for you. But I thought, she's telling me this because she wants to comfort me. But I didn't know anything that was going on in the outside world.
But one of the things you write about is a day when one of your interrogators asked you about how did you know Obama, but he said his name in such a peculiar way you didn't know who he meant.
Yeah, it was in the afternoon, and he had been grilling me about Iranians in the United States, whom I didn't know at all. These are the Iranian activists. And then suddenly he said, how do you know Obama? And I said, who? And he repeated, Obama. And I thought, who can this person be? Suddenly it occurred to me, I was a teacher of language, Persian language, so I said, oh, he probably means Obama. But I said, you mean the senior senator from Illinois? The senator from Illinois? And he said, yes, yes, yes. How do you know him? I said, how do I know him? I don't know him at all. I just went to the Council on Foreign Relations once when he was giving a talk. And he said, no, you are not telling us the truth.
And this meant you knew what that meant. What did that mean to you? What did that tell you?
I asked him. I said, why? Why do you ask me? And they said, well, he spoke about you. And the moment they said that, then Senator Obama had spoken about me, I knew that something was going on in the outside world.
That must have really lifted your spirit.
Very much so.
Now, when did you find out that you were going to finally be allowed to go?
One afternoon, I was minding my own business, doing my exercise in my cell. I was called again for interrogation. So I went there, and I had to sit and face the wall. And the senior interrogator said, you know, you're free. You can go home. And I said, you must be joking, because they were very good at doing cruel jokes, you know. So, and he said, no, just go pack up your things and go. And I said, I need to call my mother. I wanted to test them. And said, oh, she's here waiting for you. I said, what about the bail? They said, well, we took her apartment as a bail to let you go. And I said, okay. So I got up without thinking that I'm not supposed to look at the guy. And I heard some ruffling and shuffling. And I said, okay, I'll wait. So the guy walked out, And I tried to walk out, and they said, oh, no, you have to wear your blindfold, you have to put on your veil, and then you can go. I went back to my to the ward and to my cell, and I started picking up my stuff, and then I left prison.
And what was the impact of having spent this time being interrogated and then in solitary confinement? What had been the impact on you?
You know, Susan, you never forget it. It leaves a mark on you. Even to this day, sometimes at 5 in the mornings when the birds outside our home in Potomac start chirping or singing, I wake up thinking I'm in Evin, because there also at 5 in the morning the birds were singing, which would remind me of Potomac. Here, it gives me a jolt, and I keep on thinking, oh, I'm in Evin, you know.
We've seen these huge protests in Tehran and mass arrests and now mass trials starting there. Some of the people charged with offenses that sound very much like the charges against you of trying to foment a revolution. And I wonder, do you think they're related? Is what's happening today in Tehran related to what happened to you 2 years ago there?
Yes, definitely. Because, I mean, I think the seed of this paranoia of the intelligence ministry about a group of about people fomenting a Velvet Revolution was planted 3 years ago when they first arrested a Canadian-Iranian called Ramin Jahanbegloo, and then a year later they arrested me and another Iranian-American, Kian Tajbakhsh, who is a sociologist. Neither he nor I, nor I don't think Mr. Jahanbegloo had anything to do with trying to overthrow the regime or instigating or being instrumental to push for a Velvet Revolution. Unfortunately, I mean, Mr. Tajbakhsh was rearrested again 2 months ago, and he is kept in Evin. He has been put on trial, charged, while last time neither he nor I were charged. You know, this time he has been charged and he has been forced to make false confession and make accusations. And this is very unfortunate, because I know that he has been keeping a very low profile ever since he got out of prison.
These arrests, I wonder if the regime in some way is right, that these protests that we've seen in the streets reflect a turmoil there for people who want changes in the government.
I personally don't think that the people who came out into the streets were pushing for a revolution. On the contrary, all they wanted was their votes to be counted. That's all they were after. And they were not into planning to overthrow the regime. And they wanted an evolution. They wanted opening up in the society. They wanted a bit more freedom. They wanted to be able to reach out to the outside world. But I don't think they were planning to overthrow the regime, because their candidate, Mr. Mousavi, is one of them.
Could this backfire on Iran's leaders, these arrests we've seen, the mass trials that are still to come, What do you think the impact in Iran is going to be from them?
I think the impact is very negative, because people are very upset at the street scenes they have been seeing, at the Revolutionary Guards and the paramilitary Basiji shooting at young people, going to their homes, arresting them, and the stories that we hear now about torture and rape of men and women in prisons. I mean, the situation was so bad that they had to close one of the detention centers at the order of Mr. Khamenei, the leader. So I think this is going to backfire. I'm sure Mr. Ahmadinejad has its own constituency who believe these things, but the majority don't.
Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Medai, who's calling us from Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Mr. Sandieri. I'm so glad you managed to come out of there. I just wanted to speak on behalf of, and I was hoping if you might use your experience to expand on that, on behalf of many thousands of Iranians, you know, who for no real reason at all, actually, because just the regime understands that if the people are scared, they will go along with whatever happens. They're being imprisoned in prisons that are actually under apartment buildings, and they're underground. Sure. And they are not the, you know, these are not people who are known by the world or have a voice anywhere in the world. And for the sake of humanity, I would really appeal that perhaps you could say a word for those people. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank you for calling. Of course. I mean, I just gave the example of Kian Tajbakhsh because he was accused of fomenting the Velvet Revolution. Of course, I mean, there are thousands of especially young people who have been detained and we don't know what their where they are kept, what is happening to them. And I think all the various human rights organizations have been talking about them and have been sending out circulars, sure. And I use every single opportunity to talk about them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Sandra. She's calling us from Plano, Texas. Sandra, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to ask is that why do American Iranians, why do they keep going back to Iran if they know fully well that they're going to get arrested and molested, you know, just because of their success over here in the United States? Why do they go back there? What is there for them to gain?
All right, Sandra, thanks for your call.
I mean, not every Iranian who goes back to Iran is arrested and molested. They are almost over a million or more Iranian living in the United States, and maybe three or four of them have, including myself, were arrested. There are equal number of Iranian living in different parts of the world, and they go and they visit their families and come back. Unfortunately, people like myself became victim of the regime.
So talk a little about your daily routine while you were in prison. You mentioned earlier that you would do exercises. How much would you exercise each day?
7 hours, 8 hours. There was nothing else to do for me because if I didn't exercise, I had to think. And I just didn't want to think about my life. I didn't want to think about my family because that would lead me to despair. And I was fighting despair with every little cell in my body. That's what my interrogators wanted. And I didn't want to succumb to despair. So therefore, I started exercising. I would walk for hours in my cell. And while walking, I wrote two stories. One was a biography of my paternal grandfather, my paternal father, my paternal side, and she was a woman who had a lot of influence on me. So I wrote her biography in my mind. I would move chapters, paragraphs, edit, and do all these things, and which was, you know, quite time-consuming. And the children's story for my grandchildren.
So you wrote this in your head because, of course, you could not write it down. Didn't have paper, pen, and all allowed to write it down. So are you now putting these books that you wrote in your head down on paper?
I haven't had the chance yet. I just finished this book, My Prison, My Home. But I think the next one is going to be the children's story and then the biography of my paternal grandmother.
Sure. Is it still very clear in your mind, the books you wrote in your head during this time?
Yes.
And writing this book, My Prison, My Home, was it difficult to relive this very stressful experience?
It was. It really was stressful, but it was also, in a way, therapeutic because I wanted to share this experience, you know, and for me it mattered to explain that you can be in solitary confinement and you can survive. And this was very important for me, and that you can deal with these people from the intelligence ministry, and you will learn how to talk to them, how to deal with them. And I just wanted to share this experience with a lot of other people.
Hala Esfandiari is talking about her new book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones, 1-800-433-8850, and we'll read some of your emails, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Chemotherapy, MRIs, even stem cells are being used to prolong the life of pets. But how do you decide how far to take that therapy? On the next Fresh Air, we kick off our end of summer series, Animal Week, with veterinarian Nancy Kay, author of Speaking for Spot. And scientist Irene Pepperberg talks about the parrot that could tell her how it felt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hala Esfandiari has written a new book, My Prison, My Home, about her imprisonment in Iran. And just this month, you wrote in a Washington Post op-ed piece, quote, "The revolution has begun to devour its children." What did you mean by that?
Well, because the government arrested the leadership of the reformist movement, a former vice president, a former deputy minister, former members of parliament, and people close to President Khatami, and they put them all on trial. And these are insiders. These are people who rose to the rank and with the revolution. So it's really devouring its own people.
So what is the mindset, do you think, of the guards who were interrogating you?
You mean the intelligence ministry?
The intelligence ministry, yeah. Yes.
I think the intelligence ministry people had convinced themselves, you know, and continue to convince themselves that the United States has been trying to overthrow the regime in Iran for the last 30 years. And since it was bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, it will not militarily attack Iran. Therefore, it will try and bring about change through a velvet revolution like Georgia, like what happened in the Ukraine and in Georgia. And therefore, it will support NGOs in Iran. It will support women's groups. It will organize conferences and meetings. And the intelligence ministry people are paranoid about this thing. There is a sense of paranoia. They have these rooms full of charts and, you know, plans that what the United States will do. And so when they saw Mr. Mousavi starting the Green Movement, which really was accidental, he said in an interview that I was giving a talk in the provinces and a young man came and put a green shawl around my neck, and I'm being an artist. I like the color. And so did the Green Movement start. So, and they really got worried that this is the first step to bring about a velvet revolution in Iran. And that's why, and these people were just protesting the manipulation of the elections, the rigging of their votes. And so they went after them.
We have an emailer who writes, I've often wondered if the hubris of the ruling Iranian party in claiming an overwhelming majority in the election sparked the protest. Do you think there would not have been protest if the ruling party had just claimed a simple majority? And that's an email from Dee, who's writing us from West Jefferson, North Carolina.
Well, I think if they really would have been very honest and counted all the votes, and either the ruling party would have won with a slim majority or lost with a slim majority, we wouldn't have had these protests. But it was this huge manipulation of the vote that caused this protest.
And, of course, that difficulty continues on the election. Let's go to Mia calling us from Irving, Texas. Mia, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Ms. Sundari. How do you feel about writing this book and its regard to your family safety who are still in Iran, and how you feel like it's going to affect your mother who's still there and so on and so forth? Are you concerned about that at all in talking out about your experience?
All right, Mia. Thanks so much for your call.
My mother passed away 2 months ago, so unfortunately she didn't live to see the book. I don't think the book would have harmed her. You know, there is nothing in the book that I have not been saying since I have been out of Iran now for 2 years.
But even after your experience, your imprisonment, she declined to immigrate with you to the United States.
Sure.
She stayed there even after this period.
Yes, she decided to stay. As I told you earlier, she was 93 when I went to prison. She was 95 when she passed away. And she said she spent most of her life in Iran and she wanted to die in Iran.
You did have a last chance to meet with her, although not in Iran. Where did you go?
I met her in the last 2 years twice. Once in Abu Dhabi, she came to Abu Dhabi, and we met her there, and once to Vienna a month ago. So we were together there.
All right, Mia. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Chuck. He's calling us from Cleveland, Ohio. Chuck, thanks for holding on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a general comment, and I really blame a lot of the problems that occurs around the world. I want to blame some of that to the American media, because they kind of sensationalize the events that are taking place. I'll give you an example. Look what's happening in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia or the rest of the Arab countries in the Middle East in general. The United States is empowering those regimes to oppress their people and continue to suck the resources out of those countries through the autocratic regimes, just like we did with the Shah of Iran. Ms. Zardari, where were you during the Shah of Iran's regime? Did you defend that regime? Did you stand against them? I really don't have any sympathy to people that take advantage of some of the things like this that take place, and they write books to make money off of it. Second of all, our problem is in our administration. Administration after administration that continue to support those autocratic regimes, whether in South America, whether in Asia, whether in the Middle East. And we are the cause of what's going on around the world. Take Egypt, for example.
All right.
Egypt is going to become another Iran.
Okay, Chuck, thanks for your call. Hala Esfandiari, what would you say to Chuck?
Let's talk about what's happening in Iran now. I don't think the media needs to be blamed. I mean, all the media was relying basically on what was sent by Iranian protesters from inside Iran. You know, we live now in the age of internet, Twitter, and SMSs. So, I mean, and pictures that came from taken by these by phones and YouTube. So it wasn't actually, you didn't have necessarily too many reporters there. It was the demonstrators, the protesters who were passing on these messages to the outside world. So I wouldn't blame that. And I think in all fairness, I mean, the American media has been critical of what has been going on in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they have. I mean, you may agree or disagree, but if you go and check, you see that they have been quite critical of any kind of abuse of power by these regimes.
Now, Chuck mentioned the Shah of Iran. We have another caller, Cynthia from Vernon, New York, who asked, would it help if our government apologized for the overthrow in 1953 of an Iranian government? And I wonder, to what degree are we still living with the legacy of American actions during the time of the Shah?
I think the American government has already apologized under President Clinton. Secretary Albright apologized in a speech she gave. So the apology has been taken care of, I personally believe. Secondly, we are now living during a presidency of President Obama. He has been very nice towards Iran. He has reached out to Iran. He sent, for the first time, he sent a message which was addressed to the leader and to the people of Iran. He did this. He did not put a cleavage between the people and their leader. So I think we are now, President Obama has been trying to engage Iran. And I think that is the problem that the current government in Iran is facing, because the people are saying that you no longer have the former administration. You no longer have President Bush, who wanted to overthrow you. You have a president who wants to talk to you. So I think this is the biggest problem that this administration the Iranian government is facing now.
Now, what is the view, do you think, of Iranians toward President Obama? What do they think about him?
I think President Obama is very popular, not only in Iran, but around the world. I just came back from Austria 2 days ago, and I was surprised of how popular he still is, you know. There. I mean, with whoever talks, I mean, they constantly say, oh, we wish him well with the health bill. So
we'll take some more calls. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to John. He's calling us from Champaign, Illinois. Hi, John.
Hi, I just have a concern and question. After the voting and everything, when people came out, there were like 3,000 people that the Revolutionary Guards killed. And they're not sending any of them out. They're sending like one or two a day. There are a lot of people going to Evin prison every day, trying to look for their loved ones. And also there's been a lot of raping. And Voice of America and BBC, even though we pay for Voice of America to, you know, support people or whatever, they're still supporting the government. It seems like the media stopped talking about all of those things, and I wonder if she can talk about that. And going back to the history, I think President Carter was the one talk about human rights at that point. And by bringing Khomeini over because of oil prices and everything else, they destroyed the human rights. And I never heard President Carter come out and say, well, I made a mistake.
All right, John, thank you for giving us a call.
I think the allegations and accusations about the rape and torture and mistreatment of prisoners have been covered both in Iran and outside Iran, and I don't think there is a single media who has not written about these allegations, especially since the person who made it public was Mr. Karoubi, who is a cleric and also one of the four candidates in the last election. So I think that has been covered extensively. As to, the human rights issue, I think the problem that the Iranian government had with the Bush administration was the allocation of the $75 million for promoting democracy in Iran. So it isn't as if they did not promote democracy, but it backfired on local NGOs and local activists.
We have an email from Ben. He writes us from Dallas, and he says that he marched in support of the protesters in Iran after the election. What would you suggest we can do now and in the coming months and years to help these brave patriots in Iran? That's what he writes. Is there anything Americans can do if they're concerned about the situation in Iran?
Sure. First of all, Iranian Americans can get in touch with their congressmen and senators and bring pressure on them and ask them to keep the abuse, the human rights abuse, on their agenda. Secondly, I think they should support any effort that will lead to freeing the prisoners, all of them. And this means by sending letters to the leadership in Iran, writing to the Secretary General of the United Nations, writing to the White House and writing to their congressmen and senators.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to James, who's calling us from Miami, Florida. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This will be very quick. Congratulations on your book, and congratulations on your bravery as a Cuban-American. I understand your plight. That's all I have to say.
All right.
Good luck with everything you're doing. God bless you.
All right, James, thanks for your call. We'll go to Susan. She's calling us from Springfield, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air. Susan, are you there? I think that was my fault, Susan. Susan, are you there now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't use the computer keyboard quite the way I was supposed to. Now you're on the air.
Thank you so much. Hello, this is Sue Tillotson from the Smithsonian. It's so good to hear your voice again. I am so glad you're getting this opportunity. What I would love for you to share with your listeners is what you also shared with us. There was more to it that you shared with us than just exercise. You had a fabulous psychological strength to you and a mindset that allowed you to withstand this, which I think is very important for people to hear. And also at the time, Roxana, the journalist, Roxana had been previously taken and thankfully now has been released, and you were concerned about it. But would you mind sharing that with our listeners, because I think it's so valuable, and I'm so glad to hear your voice, and congratulations on your book.
All right, Susan, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Sue. I think I tried to explain that what kept me going in prison was, of course, my physical activities when I was not going through 8 hours of interrogation, but also my mental activity, which was through writing these two books in my mind and not succumbing to despair, because I kept on telling myself, I'm 67 years old, I have had a wonderful life, and they can take that away from me. They can take away my freedom now, but they can't take away my past. And that gave me a lot of courage.
The title of your book is My Prison, My Home. What does that title mean?
Well, when they put me to prison, when they put me to Evin and they took me to that cell and closed the iron door behind me and I heard the door being locked, I looked around and I said, this is going to be my home for the next God knows how long, but it's also my prison.
All right. I want to thank you, Hala Esfandiari, for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about your book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran.
Thank you very much, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.